The third and final matter on our oral calendar this morning is State versus Grimm. As counsel are getting situated, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. My name is John Rodenberg. With me today are Judges Bjorkman and Reyes. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for the recording. The podium is adjustable. If you want, there's a little toggle switch. You can adjust it up and down to meet your comfort. Whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
There. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and I represent the appellant Mariel Grimm in this matter today. I'm going to start off just by noting I believe there are three main points to discuss today that have all been very thoroughly briefed by both sides. The first issue is Ms. Grimm's application for post-conviction relief. Her second is the argument of the sufficiency of the evidence, and the third was the admission of exhibits and testimony that were from 5 days after the child was admitted to the hospital. I was planning to go in that order unless the court had specific questions and wanted me to jump in elsewhere. As far as ineffective assistance of counsel applies when counsel's performance was deficient such that it fell below the objective standard of reasonableness. In addition, there has to be a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. Now, in this case, as is always important when we're here at the Court of Appeals, is the standard of review. Now, in this case, the standard of review is that the decision to grant a hearing is reviewed by this court in an abuse of discretion. And my argument to the court is that the district court did, in fact, abuse its discretion. In addition, then, the conclusions that the court has reached are reviewed on a de novo standard. So we've kind of got this two-part approach here.
And this is a situation where the post-conviction court is the same court that heard the underlying case.
That's absolutely correct.
So not only was the court able to review the affidavit and the written arguments with respect to ineffective assistance, but the court was in some amount of position to also make an assessment based on observations during the defense.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and yes, I do understand that. Now, Your Honor, as far as the ineffective assistance of counsel, there are essentially three arguments that were put forth in the post-conviction pleadings. First, that counsel failed to request a Fry-Mac hearing. Second, that counsel failed to retain a biomechanical engineer. And third, that counsel failed to file a motion to exclude the term abusive as the full term of abusive head trauma. Now, if I look at that as I was really preparing for today, I went back to the affidavit that the attorney filed in this case. And really, when I was researching, you know, the case law on this and rereading the cases, I was really struck by the cases that I think were really cited by both counsel was that often when we're looking at an ineffective assistance of counsel, we're really looking at cases where the trial counsel still states, well, this was my trial strategy. I decided to not call this witness out of trial strategy. I decided to present this evidence more out of trial strategy. And when I was rereading the affidavit that counsel filed, that's not what counsel, in fact, says. Counsel really articulates, and I believe this is articulated well throughout the affidavit, that months prior to the trial, and this is paragraph 15 of the affidavit, that Ms. Grimm had forwarded a biomechanical engineer who was willing to help. When he in fact followed up, he was not able to use that individual. From the affidavit, he made no other efforts to contact biomechanical engineers.
I'm going to stop you. I've read the affidavit. I'm looking at paragraph 23, in which defense counsel says, my entire theory of the case was based on the state's experts being unable to prove beyond a reasonable degree of doubt or state with scientific certainty the exact etiology of the child's injuries. Doesn't that reflect a trial strategy that is generally unreviewable on ineffective assistance analysis?
Well, I think, but if you read further in that paragraph, and I think you have to take the paragraph as a whole, he does state in paragraph 23, I admit that I was not making a strategic decision in not seeking the court for monetary relief, in seeking other biomechanical engineers, or in essentially all of the other theories that are presented there.
Right, because of his theory was, I'm going to take on the experts the state brings forward. And that's exactly how the defense counsel approached the case, wasn't it?
That is what he is saying there. I think the bigger picture, though, was that he's admitting that really the decision to not hire a biomechanical engineer was not a trial strategy. It in some respects almost comes across more as he was not following up on what he should have been doing.
Well, but we have to look at what he says in context. I mean, certainly it's not uncommon for a defense counsel to fall on the sword for their client to say, mea culpa, I'm the one who's responsible. We need to look at actually what he did. And like Judge Bjorkman points out, it looks like what he was doing, it was clearly a part of his trial strategy there, and we don't review trial strategy.
There's a conflict, though, within those two sentences, in that he also says he was not making to not rehire, or to not retain, excuse me.
File a Fryam Act motion. And I mean, he's listing all the things he could have done, but it seems to me he indicates that what his trial strategy was, and that seems to be consistent with what the record would show. My question on the Fryam Act, because we evaluate in determining an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the likelihood that any ineffective conduct made a difference, I mean, you would agree with me that at the time this case came to trial, the theory of shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma was nothing new. I mean, it's a diagnosis that's been recognized by the American Academy of Pediatrics for decades, isn't it?
It is a diagnosis that has been recognized. However, when you look at the case law I think both sides really cited a lot of cases for the court to review. While there may be the diagnosis, there really does appear to be this conflict within the medical community as to really what's valid, what you should be looking at. And as you're reviewing this, especially when we're looking at, we're in a court of law. We're not in a hospital. We're not in a medical setting. We're in a court of law. And so what should be applying in that court of law? And I think that even plays even more important as to why, for example, the biomechanical engineer was so important, because part of abusive head trauma is that you not only have the triad, that you have the brain swelling, that you have the bleeding in the brain, that you have the retinal hemorrhages. Here in this case, we missed, there's no retinal hemorrhaging.
Or they didn't do it because the child was so injured they weren't able to have an ophthalmologist look at him right away, correct?
I believe one of the doctors, and I have it in my notes here somewhere, did indicate that no retinal hemorrhaging was present. And I apologize, I do have it in my notes.
Well, and I think there was testimony about how frequently you see that when you have a 13-month-old as opposed to a 6-month-old with this. But getting back to my question, I mean, in State versus Stewart, I know you're familiar with that case. I think it was cited by at least one of the parties. This court rejected a foundational challenge to the testimony that was admitted here. So, again, doesn't the fact that... And I know there wasn't a request for a Fryam Act hearing in Stewart, but yet the foundational reliability objection that the district court there rejected and we affirmed. I mean, doesn't that suggest that bringing the failure of defense counsel to bring a Fryam Act motion probably didn't make a difference?
Well, I don't think you can use that based on, I mean, the facts of Stewart definitely applied to Stewart. I mean, in Stewart's case, Stewart's counsel was arguing essentially that, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit more, I realize you were the authoring judge on that, so I'm sure you're well more familiar with some of those underlying points. But when you look at that, the counsel was really arguing specifically as to Dr. Alice Swenson, specifically as to her diagnosis in that case. And as you've already highlighted, and counsel concedes in, I believe, her responsive brief, no Fryam Act was requested.
Right, but the argument was that the theory of abusive head trauma lacks foundational reliability, and so the expert should not have been able to testify to it. I mean, isn't that, in a Fryam Act hearing, you are in fact asking for an evidentiary hearing on that question, aren't you?
Except that Fryam Act has, we are requesting an evidentiary hearing on that, except Fryam Act really does have a two-part approach. when we look at this. First, not only sort of the universal application to cases in general, but then how it's applied to the specific facts of that case. So even, and also to go even further, when you look at State v. Roman Nose, State v. Roman Nose does talk about the fact that if it has never been determined under a FRIMAC standard to be generally acceptable, then a FRIMAC hearing, you know, basically must be held. And quite frankly,
if it's a novel scientific theory.
Right, and if...
But we're not talking about a novel scientific theory here.
Except that we are talking about a diagnosis that has been shifting over time, and where more we see...
Well, that's an allegation, but was there even an offer of proof that there has, in fact, been a shift? And it seems like the courts are pretty uniform in terms of recognizing this as an issue, as a diagnosis.
Well, I do believe an offer of proof was provided in the form of the affidavit of Dr. Joseph Scheller, who did provide an affidavit with the post-conviction relief that, in fact, this is a much more debated issue, that there has been emerging science, both on the basis of the amount of force that's actually required. In fact, the diagnosis dates, you know, to some time ago, but we're looking at, there are studies that are done in the 80s and 90s and even progressing still, that are, even if you look at, sorry, I'm sort of jumping a little bit here, but even if you look at the report that was also provided by Dr. Lloyd, the biomechanical engineer, I mean, even he was a part of studies in the 2000s that were really testing what amount of force is necessary, how does that happen, can we have lucid intervals, and in fact there have been additional studies of
right,
can shortfalls really cause this.
Right, but in terms of intervals in particular, because I think that was one of the key theories that you had, right? And in terms of lucid intervals, we had at least two, if not three doctors, including the doctors who had two of the doctors who had examined her, and one who reviewed the information, who said, based on the results of what they saw, that there couldn't have been a lucid interval, that this happened within a very, very short period of time of the trauma, that the results from that, the baby's reaction happened, would have been, you know, almost immediately after that.
Right, and so there were...
Part of, and speaking of bleeding over, you know, mm-hmm. you know, falling into another one, that really goes to the circumstances proved as well. Those are part of the circumstances proved.
Well, a couple, so to sort of go back first to the timing piece and the lucid interval. When I was, at least two of the state's experts, in fact, said that the timing would actually fit prior to the child was being dropped off from daycare.
Right, but we need to look at the circumstances proved in light most favorable to the jury's verdict. So even if there's conflicting testimony for a particular witness, we have to look at that testimony that favors the jury's verdict.
Right, and I think if we look at the circumstances proved, and I'm glad you brought that up, I think if we looked at the circumstances proved, there's no doubt that the child suffered some sort of a head injury. There was
right.
the brain
the,
swelling.
There are only two circumstances proved that you list. I think there are far more than that.
Oh, yes. And there's this the hematoma, the encephalopathy. There's no doubt that the child became unresponsive in Ms. Grimm's care. I mean, that's a circumstances proved. I can't get around that fact. I'd concede that one any day of the week. We also, I think if we're looking at the circumstances proved, do have to accept some facts. The biggest piece that's missing here is the mechanism.
Which is the nature of this diagnosis, and which is why there is criticism of it, correct?
Well, right.
I mean, that's why, and doesn't that, again, go to the weight of the testimony offered by the state? Not its admissibility.
But at the same time, though, then that could also be the argument for why a FRIMAC would have been so incredibly important, is we're missing the mechanism.
But the defense counsel, for whatever reason, decided not to. And that gets back to, was the trial strategy of the defense counsel to prove the case or to try to undermine the state's proof by cross-examining the state and bringing out the flaws and arguing other causes, such as a stroke and things like that? Isn't that a reasonable strategy? It may not have been successful, but why would we, on post-conviction, find that the district court abused its discretion in failing to second-guess that strategy?
And I would just add to that there's also the fact that defense counsel actually had two doctors as well who testified to basically counteract and have a battle of the experts. That seems like a very, very reasonable strategy to undertake.
Except that those experts were all, I think I keep going back to the mechanism here, that's the biggest piece that's still missing, is that there's no proven circumstances anywhere.
Right, but why not, if the state isn't going to get into that and just prove that by circumstantial evidence rather than direct evidence, which we don't have here, and I think everybody agrees that you don't, why get into those details and why not leave that as it is and just go with and rebut to show that the circumstantial evidence is lacking here? That seems like, first of all, it seems like a strategic decision. That's clearly a strategic decision, trial strategy, and it certainly seems reasonable under the circumstances.
Except that I believe counsel was even admitting in his affidavit that, at least I guess my take on it, and I understand that there may be a difference there, but my take on the affidavit was he was essentially saying that was not reasonable for him to do, especially since the mechanism was so incredibly lacking here. We've got where, with abusive head trauma, there were no other signs of external trauma. There was no neck injury. There was no fractured ribs. There was no bruising. There was one little minor bruise, but nobody seemed to be worried about that one. So which isn't fitting with, and if I can just finish here really quickly.
You had several questions, so you can complete the thought.
Which really is not fitting with what would be appropriate in the accepted medical community for abusive head trauma. So, and I will wait and respond then to anything else on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Respondent?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Heather Pipenhagen, and I am an Assistant Dakota County Attorney. I am here today on behalf of the state of Minnesota, which is the respondent in this appeal. I would like to start off, just because we have time limitations, with addressing the district court's denial of appellant's petition for post-conviction relief. As we've already covered, this was based on ineffective assistance of counsel for essentially three alleged reasons. And it's our position that the court did not err in its findings that trial counsel's performance did not fall below an objective standard of reasonableness. And I want to emphasize objective standard of reasonableness, since there's been some talk about Mr. Kurzman's affidavit. It is not Mr. Kurzman's standard of reasonableness, and I appreciate him being an advocate in that affidavit, but the standard is an objective standard of reasonableness, and the trial court found that the trial counsel was not ineffective. So the first issue is the fact that he didn't ask for a Fry-Mac hearing on the abusive head trauma diagnosis. There was no basis to ask for a Fry-Mac hearing on the abusive head trauma diagnosis.
But there is no case in Minnesota that says that diagnosis, that theory of injury, has been subjected to the rigor of a Fry-Mac hearing, is there?
Abusive head trauma encompasses injuries from shaking, impact, and a combination of shaking and impact. There was an unpublished case as long ago as 2003, the Green case, where there was a request for a Fry-Mac hearing on shaken baby syndrome, and the Court of Appeals said, that's not novel in emerging science. You're not entitled to a Fry-Mac hearing on it. That was all the way back in 2003. So if trial counsel did research the issue of Fry-Mac on abusive head trauma or shaken baby syndrome, he would have found that case on shaken baby syndrome. There isn't a case where a court held a Fry-Mac on abusive head trauma, but Fry-Mac only applies to novel or emerging science. There's nothing novel or emerging about head trauma. We have had head trauma as long as we've had heads. I mean, head trauma is not a novel or emerging science. The characterization of head trauma as being abusive versus accidental, that's not so much science as based on facts. So when a medical provider determines there's head trauma, which in this case, that wasn't disputed, subdural hematomas, massive cerebral edema or swelling, there was no dispute about that. And the state's experts determined that was the result of trauma. Those injuries were caused by trauma. Even one of the defense experts, Dr. Chadwick, when I asked him on cross-examination, I said, if you were the treating doctor for this child, what would be your number one thing on the differential diagnosis? And he said, child abuse. I have to say child abuse. Well, child abuse resulting in subdural hematomas and cerebral edema is a very long way of saying abusive head trauma. So even the defense expert agreed that that was the most likely cause here. So there really isn't
any... that point out that perhaps the defense counsel was unreasonable in failing to pursue a biomedical engineering opinion. In fact, such opinions were proffered in the Stewart case, as I recall. And maybe that is where the defense counsel fell down.
It doesn't, because really what they're trying to say now on appeal is we don't like abusive head trauma being used in this case. We don't like abusive head trauma used to say my client did it. I don't think anybody, I don't think the appellant is saying it's not possible to inflict abusive head trauma on a child. I don't think they're saying that science isn't real. As far as your question about the biomechanical engineer, I submitted an affidavit as part of the post-conviction proceedings from the head supervisor of the child abuse prosecution team in Hennepin County, and she indicated in all the child abuse cases she's prosecuted in her career, she's never had anybody hire a biomechanical engineer. This is kind of a very, if anything, that's what's novel, is the trend to now bring in a biomechanical engineer. You can look on Westlaw, you can read all kinds of published child abuse cases. The only case I can find where a defense attorney used a biomechanical engineer was Stewart. Coincidentally, the same biomechanical engineer that submitted the affidavit in this case. So to say that that's the standard, that's the objective standard of reasonableness, is that you have to hire a biomechanical engineer, I don't agree with that. I think it's an anomaly when people hire a biomechanical engineer, and I haven't had a case where anybody has. So the other issue, if we skip to that issue, then I could keep going on Fry-Mack, but I think in the Doe v. Archdiocese case, the Supreme Court said the foundational reliability analysis in Fry-Mack with new science is almost identical to the general foundational reliability analysis. That's what this court did in Stewart when it looked at abusive head trauma. So I don't think I need to say anything more about the failure to ask for a Fry-Mack hearing. And obviously differing medical opinions don't equal a Fry-Mack hearing, or we'd have one in every single case involving medical evidence. But going to the biomechanical engineer, I don't think it was an effective assistance to not hire a biomechanical engineer for the reasons that I've already said. Additionally, a biomechanical engineer is not a medical doctor. They can't do experiments on real children. So the clinicians who are treating real children who suffer these injuries, in my opinion, are in a better position. Biomechanical engineers, everything's based on simulations and studies, not on real life. We did not bring in a biomechanical engineer, so there was no biomechanical engineering testimony to rebut, which is one of the things that the trial court pointed out in its denial of the post-conviction relief. Also, we did not and cannot, or it wouldn't have been a trial, we cannot say what the mechanism of injury was in this case. And I'll talk a little bit about that in the context of the biomechanical engineer. When you have a child abuse case that's going to trial, usually a head trauma case, if you know what the person did to that child to cause the head injury, you're probably not in trial. We don't know the mechanism in these cases when it's a trial unless the person tells us. They're the only person that knows what happened. So it's not uncommon for the state to not be able to say what the mechanism is. It's some type of whiplash, rotational injury, sometimes with impact, sometimes without. We don't know unless we're told. But that's not an element. So that's not a basis to find that there wasn't a sufficient basis for this conviction, because it's not an element the state has to prove. The state has to prove there was some intentional act. So when you rule out all of the accidental causes, that's all that's left. There's an accident, there's a fluke medical reason, which the defense tried hard to put forward the stroke theory, and then there's it's inflicted. When you have a baby that's under constant supervision, there's only so many variables on how that injury can happen. We didn't have a theory on mechanism, so there's really nothing. The biomechanical engineer would be responding in a vacuum. We're not saying this is what she did, and then he can come back and respond and say, well, that doesn't make sense based on my classroom laboratory calculations. That wouldn't happen. We didn't have a theory. We didn't have a theory about the mechanism. So there was nothing for the mechanical engineer to rebut. As I indicated, I don't think it's the typical standard for someone to call a biomechanical engineer. And of the two experts that testified, Dr. Pena Mishas, who testified for hours and hours and hours and hours at trial, he did address some of those biomechanical issues. He talked about studies. I think he was talking about studies back in the 60s with monkeys and studies they did with football players and shaking. So some of those biomechanical aspects were covered by Dr. Pena Mishas and his testimony, and Mr. Kurtzman, trial counsel, also talked to Dr. Mark Hudson about that to some extent on cross-examination. So some of those issues were covered. I'll keep going forward, then I won't go back to the Fry-Mac issue. The third issue, where they alleged ineffective assistance, was the failure to bring a motion to preclude the word abusive in the abusive head trauma diagnosis. I guess I'm a little bit confused by the issue. I mean, that is the medical opinion, that it's not accidental that this was inflicted. Any expert who's qualified and has the training and experience, a medical expert, can provide that opinion. The court touched on a very similar argument in the Stewart case, where they said that Dr. Swenson shouldn't be allowed to characterize these injuries as non-accidental. And this court in Stewart said she can. She's an expert. An expert can offer testimony about whether or not something is intentional or accidental. We see this all the time with medical examiners. I think I cited the Chambers case in my brief. We ask medical examiners all the time, what is your opinion about cause and manner of death? Was it accident, homicide? So if the expert's qualified to offer an opinion on that, the expert can offer an opinion on that. So I don't know what the basis would be. What would be the legal basis to bring a motion to preclude the use of that word? Again, I think it doesn't make a whole lot of sense considering the defense expert himself said the number one most logical explanation for these injuries is child abuse. So I don't know how the defense expert can say it, but you would bring a motion to preclude the state's experts from saying that. So I don't think there was any ineffective assistance of counsel by failing to bring that motion. Also, it wasn't inconsistent with the trial strategy in this case either. The primary, I think if you look at the closing argument, the primary defense in this case was that WM suffered a minor head bump the day before, that this cascaded, caused this stroke, and then the following day is when he became unresponsive. But clear in that closing argument was an implication that also dad could have done it, that dad could have been the one who inflicted these injuries.
But they bumped heads or something like that, didn't they?
He actually took it a little farther than that to talk about people being angry and penetrating children and getting angry when they're sexually abusing them on the changing table. There was some strange questions during trial, and then that worked its way into the closing argument with a lot of commentary about dad's suspicious behavior during the interview, and you just don't know what people will do, and there's a lot of perverts out there and things like that. So there was definitely an implication to the jury. You should also consider the fact that maybe it wasn't my client, that it was dad that did it. Well, why preclude the word abusive then, if you're going to point the finger at someone else, that someone else is the one who did it? So that was not inconsistent with trial strategy.
Can I ask you a question? I know that appellant's counsel didn't get to it, but I suspect we'll hear about it in her rebuttal argument, and that is the notion of the trial exhibits that were received that documented the child's injuries. And there was no question in this case. I know these facts are horrific and that this was a very traumatic, certainly an injury that constitutes great bodily harm. Would you agree with me that that wasn't disputed at trial? That this child suffered great bodily harm?
No, I'm thinking of the testimony from the defense experts. I don't recall either of them disputing that. I don't think that was an issue.
So how do you respond to appellant's argument that in light of that fact, the state's request to admit photographs taken after that documented the extent of the injuries had no valid reason in the case?
It did, because the elements of first-degree assault are, it's the great bodily harm, and then it's injuries that could cause death, which we put that in through the testimony of the doctors that it was a life-threatening injury, but there's other alternative elements. And I think the state is entitled to submit evidence to satisfy any of the elements that it's my duty, my burden, beyond a reasonable doubt to prove. So the other elements of great bodily harm were disfigurement or else impairment. The permanent, I mean, he says permanent impairment, but the substantial impairment. So I put the mom back up at the end of trial to just testify about what the lasting effects were of that. And then I think she went through 6 or 7 photos that illustrated what she was talking about with the extent of his disfigurement on his head, his eye. He has some issues with his eyes, and then the fact that he really is pretty immobilized.
Right, but that information was already provided to the jury through the testimony earlier, right?
Through the mother's testimony, I put the photos that went with her testimony during her testimony.
Right, but mother testified to all of those facts, right?
Correct.
So why isn't this evidence cumulative of that and prejudicial and used to and potentially used to inflame the passions of the jury then?
Well, one, I think it was very limited. I mean, it was a handful. I don't recall if it was 6 or 7 photos. It was a handful.
Even if it's only a handful, one photo can be enough.
I think with the exception of maybe one of the photos that showed the disfigurement on his head, I mean, the child was clothed. It was simply pictures of him doing his physical therapy and showing how he now has to stand on a board. That's a concept that's not, certainly wasn't familiar to me. I didn't realize what this standing board was. The mom described it in her testimony, but until you see it, you don't really know what she's talking about, this board that he had to be strapped to, and that's the only way they can get him to put weight on his feet. The pictures were simply to give the jury the visual of what she was talking about. I think they were limited. I think defense attorney objected, and we kept it very brief, and I certainly don't think that had an impact on the verdict in this case.
All right. It looks like we have no additional questions. Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Thank you. So if it's all right, I was going to jump in on that last issue that was brought up. Counsel talked quite a bit about the photos were not alarming. Sorry, I think it went up. However, when I first looked at those photos, I mean, they're shocking. There's no other way to put it. And I think we have to be especially sensitive. The subject of child abuse is an especially sensitive topic. Nobody wants, there's no question this child was an innocent 13-month-old child. We can't, that's a fact I don't think anybody would come in and dispute.
Are there any cases that would suggest that these photos, and I, there were 6 or 7 of them I reviewed, that the nature of these photos are such that it was abuse of discretion by the district court to admit them?
Your Honor, from what I recall in researching, I do not believe we found any. I believe our argument really rests on the rules of evidence 403. And that really the only point was that this was prejudicial. And there was a significant amount of testimony that was provided about the nature of the child's injuries, his presentation. The doctors were able to testify. In fact, mom testified originally. And so we already had a significant amount of testimony to really, quite frankly, to put mom on last to then lead into the defense. And then even one photo is too much, especially when we're looking at this, and especially when we're looking at the defendant's right to a fair trial and that we don't bring in evidence that's overly prejudicial. Even one photo can be too much, especially given how sensitive these cases are, and that really then is the burden of the district court to make sure the jury isn't essentially running away with this, and that becomes the primary focus, and they want to hold somebody accountable.
Of course, it was a 10-day trial, right?
Yes.
In context, there was plenty of evidence of these things, and not in pictorial fashion.
there was plenty of evidence prior to the photos ever being introduced, right, which it makes it cumulative.
I agree. It seems like it may be cumulative. What I'm suggesting, though, is that in the context of a 10-day trial, it seems unlikely that the verdict is attributable to some photos when there was all this other evidence.
Except that the photos then, you know, then they're there as the evidence. They're there when you think about the concept of a jury seeing that photographic image. That's what's burned in your brain. I mean, to see those photos, I was looking at them again preparing. I mean, those are images in any of these child abuse cases. Those photos are basically burned in your brain.
They certainly show substantial bodily harm that this...
They do, except that to show those, I mean, there was significant other evidence that was already presented that essentially established that there was substantial bodily harm, and quite frankly, that issue was never an issue.
Can I change your focus? Just, we've talked about a number of things during the limited time. What would you describe as your strongest argument for reversal?
Quite frankly, I would go back to the ineffective assistance of counsel, and that's just, I know counsel talked about earlier that she's never seen a biomechanical engineer. I don't practice a significant amount of criminal law, but I do a lot of child abuse cases, and I've done them now for a number of years. And quite frankly, I have been hiring biomechanical engineers on every single case where there's an allegation of abuse for the last couple years. Because they are so important, because when you look at this, when you look at what these child abuse pediatricians are saying, they start using language about the amount of force that is necessary.
Right, and it's a rule-out diagnosis, right? I mean,
right.
You look at what the reported traumas, if you will, or reported incidents involving the child, and do those explain the situation
right.
that developed, and so...
And contrary to what counsel was indicating, that we rely on the clinicians, the only individuals that have really actually done the testing are the biomechanical engineers, and this is not just simulated. These are cadavers. So what I think everybody would agree it would be completely unethical to test on live children. Nobody's going to ever go and do that, which means we are left essentially with the cadavers. But they are actually testing on cadavers. In fact, Dr. Lloyd in his exhibit talks about he was part of a number of studies, both one with cadaver heads as well as cadaver bodies. And so they are doing the studies, and that is why they are so important. If I had to go to a second one, you know, my second one, and I apologize, I'll finish up really quick, it would actually be submitting those photographs. And that really, quite frankly, is just that image that is burned in your brain that is going to be carrying with anybody for quite some time and would then, in theory, carry into the jury room. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision within 90 days of today's date. That is the last matter on our oral calendar this morning, and so we are in recess.
All rise.